In Backtrack by Mark Cameron, the past is a prologue for a violent criminal with three names, Ricky Lee Pink. Pink's been rotting in jail for years plotting revenge against the man who thwarted his almost perfect theft of $5 million in diamonds. That man, Wayne Cutter, is deceased, but his grandson Arliss is very much alive. For now. Pink and Cutter are about to collide in a violent confrontation on a floating city in the middle of the water, a massive cruise ship traveling around Alaska's Inside Passage. An experienced U.S. Marshal, Arliss must move fast but cautiously, or he may be the last of the Cutter family tree. A must-read for fans of wilderness suspense, Mark Cameron's realistic, thrilling Man vs. Wild storyline set in the beautiful yet dangerous Alaskan wilderness are must-reads for outdoor enthusiasts and fans of wilderness thrillers by authors C.J. Box and William Kent Kruger, as well as fast-paced action thrillers from the likes of Brad Thor and Jack Carr. An Alaska resident and Texas native with nearly 30 years in law enforcement, Cameron is a master of action and gritty detail. He brings explosive authenticity to Backtrack, as U.S. Marshal Arliss Cutter's manhunt will employ all his skills and knowledge as a member of the U.S. Marshals. Backtrack by Mark Cameron is available now wherever books are sold.
Donna Sue Adelson is serving a life sentence in the state of Florida, which actually means life, and she is 76 years old. For her participation in the murder-for-hire plot of Dan Markell. But now she is saying the evidence was insufficient, that the jury pool was poisoned, she was prevented from showing emotion, and she was not given a fair opportunity to decide whether to testify. It is always poor little Donna Sue Adelson. We're about to look at the appeal that was filed.
Welcome to the global phenomenon, Surviving the Survivor, where we bring you the best guests in all of true crime. Here's your host, Emmy Award-winning journalist, Joel Waldman.
What's up, SDS Nation? Welcome to Surviving the Survivor. This is the global phenomenon, bringing you the very best guests in all of true crime and also the best trials, bringing you the Lindsay Clancy trial. No more depressing trial than that one. We've been bringing to you gavel to gavel, and we'll continue to do so until we reach a verdict. We'll be back on that at 8:50 in the morning. But with Donna Sue Adelson's attorney, Jackie Fulford, her appellate attorney, and also her criminal defense attorney, one and the same, she finally filed an appeal, and they are complaining about a number of issues that we're going to go over with Tim Jansen, and Joe Petuto is supposed to join, and we are trying to figure out where Prof. Joe explains is. But you have to go back to July 18th of 2014. That is when two hitmen approached Dan Markell in his Tallahassee driveway and fire shots at him. The trigger man convicted, Sigfredo Garcia, is serving a life sentence. The only one who cut a deal was his partner in crime, Luis Rivera, who's actually set to get out in a number of years. And he is the only one. The middle woman, you've got Katie Magbana, while also serving a life sentence with rumblings that maybe some sort of deal is cut, and she doesn't end up serving a life sentence. But two people who likely will, Charlie Adelson, whose appeal was denied, the former ex-brother-in-law of Dan Markell, and of course the ex-mother-in-law, none other than Donna Sue Adelson. We're about to break down this appeal and what it was all or is all about. But first, this note and message about sharks. One thing that terrifies all of us is sharks lurking in the water. But there is one shark that my family loves and simply can't live without, because this shark protects against cyber predators. And of course, I'm talking about Surfshark. It's a cybersecurity powerhouse that protects you in all aspects of your online and digital life. Think about it. Every time you're online, it is like to data collectors what red meat is like to actual real life sharks. But Surfshark protects you while you're using things like public Wi-Fi at airports or cafes, or even if you're shopping online. I mean, it seamlessly hides your IP address so those predators can't get to it and hackers can't snoop on your activity. Plus, Surfshark includes an email scam checker, plus 24/7 monitoring that alerts you if your personal info is ever leaked. Unlike the sharks in the water near us, Surfshark gives you total peace of mind by covering unlimited devices with just one account. So what are you waiting for? Hurry up right now and go to surfshark.com/surviving or use code surviving at checkout to get 4 extra months of Surfshark. It's risk-free with a 30-day money-back guarantee. And the famed Tallahassee criminal defense attorney and tan as hell R. Timothy Jansen. There are plenty of sharks around him, both the human and the animal kinds. What is a shark, Tim, is a shark a reptile? I think it might be a reptile. I don't know what the hell a shark is. Shark a mammal, a reptile? Someone let me know.
Mammal, maybe? I don't know if it's a reptile. I don't know. Yeah. It's a good question.
I have no idea. I should know. We should know, Tim, but we don't know. Tim is a criminal defense attorney out of Tallahassee. He's been an OG member of STS. We're proud to say that. And he is a former federal prosecutor. Tim, this was almost like a comedy of, it is a cartilaginous fish. A cartilaginous, I never heard of the word cartilaginous in my life, but it's got cartilage in the fin. That is for sure.
Okay.
Guess it's not a mammal or a reptile. Who knew? Mammal, it gives live birth. Already we're off the rails, and it is early on. Tim, this is like a 108-page appeal, if I remember that number correctly. Mary Dean already gifting 5 memberships. Feel like this is going to be a weird show. Joe Petuto, who is always on point, was supposed to join at 5. I don't know if she got the time mixed up. Steve Cohen is on that. But the show must go on. Let's obviously hope that everything is okay with Joe, which I'm sure it is. But so, Tim, there was an issue filing this appeal, and it's a strange subplot because attorneys were trying to contact Donna and they couldn't reach her. And then Court TV unsealed some information that I guess was supposed to be kept somewhat private. And it turns out that Donna had been suffering from an abscess on her arm, approximately the size of a tennis ball, and was in quote unquote excruciating pain. They say prison medical personnel are suspecting MRSA, which is a drug-resistant staph infection. A lot of fighters get this when they're rolling around all sweaty on those mats. But let's first just go to the point. I mean, you have a lot of clients that have spent a lot of time in prison. You've got this 76-year-old woman. I mean, a tennis ball size abscess is huge. They believe it to be MRSA. It does not respond to antibiotics. This is a potentially really serious ailment because there are things like sepsis where you can get poisoning, I think, from something like this. I guess my bottom line question, Tim, which is a statement, is prison is not a pleasant place, Tim, and it is not sanitary. It sounds like Donna is suffering in there right now.
Well, no, prison is not sanitary. They give you limited conditions. You have limited health care. You're not going to get the same health care as Donna would get on the outside with her doctors. She'll come into exposure with, all kinds of bacteria that probably she would never come in contact. If untreated and unnoticed, it could get to the degree where it's very serious. And it sounds like it was very serious. And yeah, sepsis is something really serious that could be life-threatening. And MRSA is not something that's easily treatable, and certainly not easily treatable in an institution.
Yeah, that's a good point. Law nerd says, oh, no, she's fine. She's being a drama queen. maybe not. I mean, 76. I mean, I'm sure there's some drama infused, but it sounds like it's not a good thing. Ironically, it was on August 7th, which was Carm's 87th birthday. Donna sought emergency medical attention again, and she was reportedly admitted for treatment and given an IV.
Yeah,
but her attorneys, and it is Jackie Fulford. We'll get to that in a second. But Jackie Fulford said that they were unable to communicate with her despite scheduled calls. And at that point, they were supposed to review the appellate brief with their client before filing. So, I mean, Tim, how important is it that the lawyers kind of had their hands tied because she was in a medical situation and they couldn't speak to her and they couldn't get final approval? Here comes Prof. Joe. Hey, Professor Joe. Prof. Joe.
Sorry, the link didn't work the first time.
No worries at all. So we're talking about Donna's possible MRSA. She has a tennis ball size abscess on her arm. And Tim, what I was saying is that on August 7th, she was given medical attention again, including an IV. But the attorney said, look, we can't reach our client. I know you're not an appellate attorney, Tim, but they couldn't file because they couldn't reach her. I mean, obviously a big problem with the clock ticking down. I don't think they knew what to do, Tim.
Well, that's true. Most lawyers, the client makes a decision in almost all cases except trial strategy and objections that the lawyer does. But big issues, motions, defenses, the client usually signs off on those because if you don't, then you can get an ineffective assistance. And on appeals, the appellate lawyer should go over the client. What issues are we going to appeal? Let's pick the best issues. Do you agree with this? And usually they sign off. But when you have an issue where you talk and then something comes up and then you want your client to sign off and they can't sign off, the lawyer has a dilemma. You got strict deadlines to file these. So in an abundance of caution, she probably should have asked for a stay or an extension. And then if that didn't work, she probably needed to file it and hope that the client, that they had discussed it previously. But it is something the client has a right to know what's going on and have input.
Yeah. Go ahead, yeah. Joe Petuto. No need to raise your hand.
Well, I don't want to. I agree with Tim, except she got an extension, the automatic one that you get. And then she asked for another extension and she didn't follow the rules as to how to do it. And then she needed a third extension. And for all this time, they couldn't write the brief and show it to her. I don't believe it.
I agree with Joe. You can get an extension, right, Joe? But if you can't get three or four extensions, then it can't be because your client or your lawyer is incompetent, doesn't know how to draft an appeal or file it properly.
This would have been the third. And then, did you get a chance to read this brief?
I mean, I did.
Honest to God. Yeah. I have a list that I would love to go through. It just, oh my Lord.
Yeah, we're gonna go through it. I mean, Tim, let me just hop in real quick. How unusual is it that the same attorney she used as her criminal defense attorney, Jackie Fulford, is also her appellate attorney? Is that unusual?
It's very unusual today, these days, because the trial lawyer should not be the appellate lawyer. He can assist the appellate lawyer, but they need to have a fresh, objective view of everything. And the trial lawyer can assist. But trial lawyers are trial lawyers. Appellate lawyers are special. They do this every day. They know how to do it. They know issues. They know case law. Trial lawyers don't. So while a trial lawyer may know what happened in court and can tell the appellate, the trial lawyer may not know the most recent case law on appeal and the issues that were best for this client. It's not a good idea to have the trial lawyer be the appellate lawyer. I would not. Yeah. My opinion.
Shout out to Matt Breff, giving us a super chat, friend of mine, friend of the show. And two things. This may or may not be his real name, and you may or may not have seen him on television before. How about that for a little intrigue? We've got a unique community. You don't know who's who inside STS Nation, but obviously a very good guy. And here we go from Truth Seeker. You don't have to be in isolation for MRSA. No, you don't. This was what Joe was saying. Let me just go through this and then we'll get to the points of the appeal. But so there was this first deadline. They couldn't reach her. Then she goes and gets medical care again, an IV, and they're still having trouble reaching. The lawyers are having trouble reaching Donna. And then the deadline is August 14th. And the attorneys say they're not sure whether they don't know at this point. Will the appellate court consider Donna's medical condition a sufficient emergency to extend the deadline? So according to their very own filing, they decide to submit the brief anyway. But this is like a comedy of errors. A storm causes internet problems when they try to send it. And in their haste, they upload the wrong document. So what went to the court was an unfinished outline slash draft without a table of contents or a table of citations and with the facts still in numbered outline form. They figured out their mistake on Sunday night and then filed an emergency motion asking the appellate court to substitute the complete amended brief. I mean, Joe Petuto, if I am the appellate panel here, I'm just immediately rubber stamping this as no appeal, just based on this clownery.
Well, it's crazy, I will admit, but I think they will accept it. Because, I mean, whatever went wrong with this brief, I don't really think you can attribute it to the client. She picked the wrong lawyers. And in fact, it isn't, I don't even think it was Jackie Fulford that did this brief. It was somebody in the office who, I guess she's a lawyer, but my God, she can't write English. This brief fails on so many grounds. I can't even get the words out.
Yeah. By the way, we've been covering Lindsay Clancy for 15 days. It's so heavy. So not that Donna is not heavy, but it's heavy in a different sort of way.
Joe, this before we even get to the law, which I think is silly. I think the arguments are silly. But she had syntax errors, typos, spelling errors, putting a comma between the subject of a sentence and the verb, sentence fragments, run-on sentence, colloquialism. Let me read you one of the lines in this brief. Quote, saw a bundle of, that's another one. Let me give you the other one first, because there was more than one. Here's a line from the statement of facts. Quote, kind of jumping around in the passenger seat. That's what she thinks you should be writing in a brief. And then there also was a false agreement antecedent. So here, I'll just give you one. There were many. Quote, saw a bundle of 100 bills stapled together that totaled $1,000 while she was with Charlie. I mean, that while she was with Charlie doesn't belong there. This brief was rife with these, as I say, before you even get to the legal argument. The legal argument was no better, in my opinion.
Tim, before we get to you, on July 30, this is from the actual brief. On July 30, 2026, the court granted a previously filed motion for extension, ordered that the appellant's initial brief had to be filed by August 14, 2026. On August 7, 2026, appellant filed a motion for extension of time for filing initial brief due to a medical emergency because she could not communicate by phone confidentially or meet with her attorneys prior. On August 10th, appellant filed an amended motion, and around and around we go in this. Again, it's just like a comedy of errors. I mean, Tim, I get mistakes happen, but I mean, when you put a brief and you upload it and it's not the right document, I mean, what does it say about the professionalism? I mean, at the end of the day, the buck stops with, I think, Jackie Fulford here, if she's going to be the appellate attorney. This is like Michael Ufferman basically sending a cartoon, as a brief, I mean, is what it amounts to. I mean, doesn't Jackie Fulford have to at least answer to Donna on this? If I'm Donna, I am mad as hell.
All right. We spend our whole show in the darkest corners of humanity, right? So let's talk about how you come back down after that. It's Mood at Mood.com. Federally legal, hemp-derived THC shipped discreetly right to your door. I'm talking no dispensary, no fluorescent lighting, and no awkward small talk. They've got gummies, flowers, edibles, and pre-rolls, all sorted by the vibe that you're actually after. Whether that's sleep, focus, a little euphoria, or let's just call it better evenings. The one people keep reaching for is the Sleepy Time Advanced Gummies, their best seller. For when your brain finally needs to stop replaying the timeline and just let you rest. You just head to mood.com, shop by mood, and pick your lane. Everything is backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee. And first-time buyers get 20% off the entire order with code STS. That's mood.com, code STS. Listen, you survived the episode, you might as well sleep like it.
Well, one, Professor Joe's a tough professor. And
that's true. Well, Jackie's definitely failing her class.
Yeah, I don't think she would even read the rest of her, but she probably would. But listen, every lawyer knows you have a deadline filing thing. You don't wait to the last minute to file something. You have to prepare for your assistant, whoever types it, is going to be out. The computer goes down. Your internet goes down. Michael Lufferman would never miss a deadline like this. He would never file it with no table of contents. He's a professional. He probably has it ready to go. He has staff read it a couple times, and then he signs off. He probably files it a day before the deadline in case there's a problem, double checks it was filed before the deadline. That's what you do. We are always caught with deadlines. Things come out, you know, but you got to make sure they're done properly. You got to double check them on an appeal or even serious motions. You have another lawyer in your office review it, read it, because you're thinking, but you're not writing. And when you write mush, the judge is going to be thinking your case is mush. Whereas a third person looking at it can say, this doesn't sound good, right?
I mean, there used to be spell check. Now you could even run it through ChatGPT and just say, hey, does this make sense at least? But obviously,
I don't think you should run it through ChatGPT. I don't swear.
Jackie, obviously, she didn't think so either. But look at this. All the way in the kingdom of Lesotho. I did not know in Lesotho they are learning English from the English. And she says, haha, Professor Joe, I also pay attention. So even in the kingdom of Lesotho, they're finding it entertaining that this brief, and we are a global phenomenon, so we want the kingdom of Lesotho to weigh in here, of course. This is slide number two. The COE puts in the elements. The undersigned asks the court to treat these two motions as confidential, maybe because it was so ridiculous. On August 11, 2026, the court issued an order regarding the confidential information contained in the motion, permitting counsel to file a motion regarding confidentiality within 10 days and holding the motions. I don't know if that has in regard to the screw-ups of the motions or the medical issues, but Joe Pituto, there are a few big issues raised in here. One of the first ones is there wasn't enough evidence to convict Donna Adelson as a principal, arguing that the trial judge should have granted her motion for judgment of acquittal, a JOA, because the evidence was legally insufficient to prove that she participated in Dan Markell's murder as a principal. I mean, they're going back to the most basic thing, which appears to, you know, be hollow. But now Jackie Fulford is going back and underscoring it. And here's a direct quote from the appeal. Appellant was not the mastermind behind the murder of Dan Markell. That is what they're saying. Your response.
Yeah, now that was, this one refers to the murder one count. And of all the points here, and I don't think any of them will succeed, this is the strongest of them. The claim is that for murder one, she's got to have done something, maybe not substantial, but at least something tangible, in aid of the murder. Where I think this one goes wrong is two ways. One, Dan Markell was shot on one day and died the next day. For murder, you have to have not just the intent to kill and causation, but you have to have a death. The death occurred the day after. And what's important here is, if you recall, the night of the murder, Donna is stopping at Charlie's to turn over some of the money to pay the hitman. That is more than enough conduct to cover murder one. And I think that's the way an appellate court would look at it. You do not have the murder until the day after, because nobody's died until the day after. I also think there's a second argument here, which is this is a murder for hire. And I don't think you get a complete crime there until somebody's paid something. Again, she not only pays the night of, but then she has those repeated payments after.
Yeah. And Tim, I mean, to Joe's point, this goes even deeper. Jackie Fulford and company on the appeal side now argue that she never agreed to the murder plot and did not pay for the crime to be carried out. Joe is talking about this. The brief repeatedly emphasizes the absence, this is important, of a direct connection between Donna and the actual killers. I remember someone during the trial saying that, I think it was Georgia maybe, saying that a conspiracy is like a train moving, and you can be in separate cars, but you're all going to the final destination. And they're arguing, well, Donna never interacted with Luis or Sigfredo, and maybe not Katie, although we don't know about that. But, I mean, that's not an argument that's going to hold up under appeal, is it? I mean, because of this notion of a conspiracy.
Right. Really, most times they say conspiracy is like a hub of a wheel, mm-hmm. and they go out all different ways. But the wheel is still the wheel, right? The conspiracy is still the whole wheel, and parts of it go different ways. One person does one job, another does another. They all combine for the conspiracy. This is the issue that they were hoping for, and this is why Donna did not testify, okay? This is why Donna wanted to testify. She was reluctant to not testify, but her lawyers told her, if you testify, you lose inefficiency of the evidence because your credibility alone, a jury could convict you. She wanted to testify, but her lawyers convinced her the government hasn't proven the case. Don't testify. We've got this issue on appeal. And I think this is clearly why she didn't testify, why she was, and she was fighting her lawyers. And but I think this is the strongest issue, even though I don't think it has merit, because I agree with Joe. It was a hired hit. People paying for the hit, right? The crime has not been completed yet. So, yeah, I still think they're going to the appellate court will rule against her.
I mean, Charlie's getting his toe rolled over. Now Donna's got this tennis-sized abscess. I mean, they're both, I mean, it is, if it wasn't so sad, it might be funny, but it's kind of adding up to be pathetic at this point. But, Joe, in this first point, the appellate team also stresses here that Catherine Magbanua, that her testimony, the so-called middle woman here, that according to the brief, Magbanua said that Donna was not involved in conversations between Katie and Charlie or Katie and Sigfredo concerning either harming or killing Dan. Again, this is just another way of saying that she was never actually caught talking or being connected to them, but there was apparently enough circumstantial evidence to tie them all together.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. There are no phone calls, at least on the wiretaps, that do that. But so what? I mean, a hit person doesn't have to be talking to the person who's going to be doing the hit. Right. You want to have, you know, if you're going to do it right, I don't want to give advice to anybody. If you're going to do it right for a murder for hire because you want to insulate yourself, well, then you certainly don't want, you want to be as far away from the conduct that causes the death as you can get, if you've got a brain anyway. Although I shouldn't say this, but I doubt whether she has one. Or at least a functioning one when it comes to this, her loss, her legal case.
Yeah, sorry. By the way, this is the table of contents. I think they forgot to add initially when they uploaded the wrong document. I would have loved to have seen that, by the way, the look on their face when they realized it. But by the way, Jackie Fulford probably watches this and is just like, I hate that guy. I hate these people. They're constantly riding us. Well, sorry about that, Jackie. The defense, this is now point number two, one of the major points in this appeal. The defense now, Tim Jansen, is trying to move Donna away from the murder and to a quote-unquote accessory after the fact, territory. That's what they're trying to do. They're arguing that there's no evidence that Donna made a payment before the murder, which I don't remember because I thought the you know, we had the accountant on, the forensic accountant, and I thought there was plenty of checks going out. But according to Donna's lawyers, they're arguing there's no evidence Donna made a payment before the murder or personally promised payment before the murder. What do we do with this? Or what is it? What does the appellate panel do with this?
Well, I think Joe is right. If someone hires a hitman, if they're smart and they got money, they don't want the hitman to know who hired the hitman. They're not going to pay the hitman, okay? They're certainly not going to pay the hitman the money before the murder is done. That's not how it's done.
Well, it is, because you remember Charlie said, you know, the guys from Florida came up on, you know, on the come.
Right. But no, but you're right. But so, yeah, You're going to do the hit. Maybe you get a down payment. Maybe you get some money, some good earnest money to show your good faith or cover your costs, which I think they did. I think they did get some money the first trip. But Donna doesn't have to have communication with the killers or even with Katie. As long as there's an understanding and Charlie is communicating that. If Charlie's communicating that to Donna or to the hitman, that's sufficient. You know, you don't have to have every co-conspirator know each other. That's not a requirement in the law. And most times they don't.
Yeah. And in this argument, Joe, they continue, by the way, this is, I don't know how, what to call this, but may Donna live to 120, which is what Phil said, but this one is amended with, where she lived to 120 with MRSA. I'll just leave that out there. But Jackie Fulford argues, Joe, that even if Donna dropped cash at Charlie's house after the murder and later signed Magbanua's payroll checks, they argue that that could establish culpability, but as an accessory after the fact. And aren't we wading into like weird territory here? Because now they're almost making an admission. They're saying, okay, well, now like it's like she did it, but she did it as an accessory after the fact. How careful do you have to be in the wording? Obviously, they're not too careful because they made spelling mistakes. But with this particular point that they're trying to bring forth, they're now trying to pivot to an accessory after the fact. At the end of the day, like, I don't even know what this does, because even if she's found to be an accessory after the fact, she's still serving like 30 years or whatever, you know? So
it's a hefty sentence. But no, I agree. If you're going to make that sort of argument, you have to be very, very careful. But again, I say the payment was made before the murder was completed, either because you say it's for hire or because he didn't die until the next day. And you can't have a murder when somebody's still alive. And the night that she stopped at Charlie's and left the money that Katie then took and didn't look to and gave it to Sigfredo, that night, Dan Markell was still alive. So I don't know how they get there. If anybody looks at the dates here, I mean, unless we're going to say that the definition of murder doesn't apply when somebody's been shot and you know he's not going to live. But I don't see why an appellate court would do that.
Here we go. Professor Joe makes so many excellent points. That's why she's the professor and we're not. That's why. Money laundry or laundering money. Another comment. And it goes on, Tim. It says, you know, they highlight the Jackie Fulford and team on the appeal here highlight evidence that Charlie supposedly told Donna about his connection to the killers in September. After the murder, 2 months after the murder, the defense ties that timing to evidence that Donna began signing checks from Charlie's dental business on September 17th, 2014. I'll be honest, I don't remember what the forensic accountant said, but again, Tim, if they're coming out and admitting, okay, well, Donna didn't start signing checks until September 17th, 2014, at the very least, like they're saying, she's an accessory after the fact. What benefit does Donna get if this is, let's say, hypothetically reduced from a murder, first degree murder charge to an accessory after the fact? She's still never walking out of prison. It's like potato, potato. What does it matter, I guess, is my question.
Well, they're hoping that the court finds they didn't have enough for first degree murder, finds there was for accessory. Then she would go back for sentencing, and then she'll get a sentence where she'll get out one day. I'd have to go back and look what accessory after the fact, what the maximum is. It may be 20 or 30 years, and that's still more than she's probably going to live. You know, the conspiracy continues. Even cover-up is part of the conspiracy when you cover up a crime. I just, when you make these close calls, like you're saying, you're going to admit certain parts of the case. You have to get the client's signature. Now, she went into trial and said, my client did pay my client, but it was after the murder. You have to get the client to sign that off. The judge is going to make sure that the client, the defendant on the record, allows that. Because if you don't, you're committing malpractice. You can't be admitting crimes on behalf of your client without your client agreeing to it. Sounds like that's what they're doing in this appeal. And maybe that's why they really wanted her to sign off on this. But it reeks of unprofessionalism, the way the thing was filed, when it was filed, how it was filed. And Joe's talking about how it was written. It just, appellate court looks at this, and they look at this, and they, like a professor looks at an exam. And if the person can't write a sentence, and they can't make a clear, coherent argument, that grade is not going to be very good. And if you're an English major and you can write very well, clear and concise, you make it look more persuasive. And it makes you look like you understand the elements, and you usually get better grades in law school. English majors do really well in law school.
The ever generous Judy Herbert here with a $50 super chat. So happy to see the three of you talking Donna Sue, a nice break from the Clancy trial. Thank you, SGS. Let me take, thank you, Judy. Real quickly, in the Lindsey Clancy trial, everyone's talking about this. At one point today, the prosecutor has the grandmother on the stand. Tim, you texted me about this.
I did.
She is of the Catholic faith. The prosecutor says, are you Catholic? Yes, I'm Catholic. And it was, she follows it up. Are you aware that murder is a mortal sin? And law professors and others are absolutely horrified, saying this is the worst question they've ever seen posed in a court of law. There's supposed to be a separation of church and state in the court. Carol Erskine, who's a well-known judge up in Massachusetts, even cited the law that this should never be admissible in a court of law. And now you're attacking a grandmother who lost her three grandkids. Real quick, Tim, what do you think of that moment in court today?
I heard that. I could not believe the unprofessionalism. She's pinning it on the mother-in-law, not the mother, Patrick's mother. She didn't commit the murders. And attacking someone's religion, and my sister is here. She's very religious. She goes, oh, my God, I would vote not guilty right now. Just by that, attacking. The case is supposed to be won on facts. The prosecutors in Plymouth have been unprofessional from the very beginning. Their appearance, their dress, their style. And I just find it, I don't know what happened to law schools. I don't know what happened to training for prosecutors, but they haven't gotten it.
Yeah, Tim, I mean, Joe, here's a prosecutor in an open court cross-examining a witness who's the grandmother of these murdered children. And she says, you're Catholic. Are you aware that it is a mortal sin to commit murder? Isn't it a mortal sin to ask that question in court? I mean, you're not supposed to bring God into court. Your thoughts?
Not in that way, for sure. Well, I didn't get to watch it because I'm watching the Fernandez-Saldana trial, but I had been watching up until this week, and I have no idea what those prosecutors were doing. I have no idea what their theory of the case is. I have no idea why they called the witnesses they did. I have no idea why they called witnesses to repeatedly say the same thing over and over and over again that sounded like it was helping the defense more than it was helping the prosecution. So this seems to me to be just more of the same. Now it's, you know, it, and what does it, I mean, the question even, take religion out of it, the question bothers me. As, you know, what is it that you're trying to get out of this witness? You want the witness to say, well, you're right, I killed the kids. Well, clearly she didn't kill the kids. I mean, she wasn't in the house.
That's a great point. Yeah, I mean, aside from the religion, yeah, she's attacking the grandmother, like accusing her of the murder. I mean, just a very low blow.
And if she wanted to get at the grandmother, she should have said, are you aware that perjury is a mortal sin? Lying under oath is a mortal sin. That would at least relate to the grandmother's testimony. I do not know what they're doing.
Tim makes a good point, too, because I think you said your relative is there, who's your sister, who's religious, but you don't have to be a religious Catholic. If anyone on this jury panel is a religious person, they might be really offended by that question, and who knows how it's going to play out. I wonder if the common, and then, by the way, someone asked, did the judge say anything? As far as I know, the judge said not a word.
Defense didn't object.
And the judge is Sullivan Irish. He's probably an Irish Catholic.
Yeah.
And they're probably Catholics on, I guarantee you there's Catholics on.
I agree. Well, they had something come up earlier where the prosecutor wanted said that there were people walking in and out of the security room where Lindsay goes on breaks, and they wanted a list, and one of them was a priest. I am not going to ask the priest these questions. So Tim.
The judge shot that down, saying she has a right to see her religious priest.
Yeah, you're right.
And by the way, we'll hop back to Donna, but the psychologist who was along with the priest going into that room, he took the stand today and said that he listened to the call between Lindsay and Patrick, and she told Patrick that she heard a male voice telling her that she had to unalive the children and then unalive herself. So this might be a missing puzzle piece that the jurors need in order to find her not criminally responsible. But Joe Pituto, back to Donna here, back to the issue of evidence. Issue one, there wasn't legally sufficient evidence to convict her. And then they say, even if there was technically enough evidence to send the case to the jury, the resulting guilty verdict was against the law or weight of the evidence. What does that even mean? I don't understand.
Yeah, it's a technical difference. There might be just enough to convict, but, this shouldn't stand. The weight of the evidence should suggest something else. It's a very technical difference, and it happens occasionally in appellate cases, but, boy, I wouldn't want to hang my hat on that argument.
All right. Before we move forward on this appeal that was initially filed at the wrong document, let's take a trip down memory lane here with Donna Sue Adelson. This is pre-tennis ball-sized abscess and Charlie having his toe, actually, this might have been post, I don't know. Anyway, Charlie's toe was rolled over as well. Here we go.
People took him from all of us who loved him. My heart was broken when Danny died. My grandsons were going to grow up without the father who loved them. I wondered, how could we help these boys through this trauma? It was then that my husband and I knew that the best way to honor Danny's memory would be to share with these children an abundance of love, the love that Danny would have given them if he were alive. It is interesting how the state can't make up its mind about who is what they call the, quote, mastermind behind this murder. In both of Catherine Magbanua's trials, the state claims she was the mastermind behind Danny's murder. In my son Charlie Adelson's trial, they claimed he was the mastermind. And now in my trial, they claimed that I, this grandma, was the mastermind behind the murder. I had no...
This grandma who told my daughter to dress my grandchildren up as Hitler Youth, this lovely grandmother. Tim, I'll keep playing this in a moment, but let's take a little break, because one of the points and the reason we play this is Jackie Fulford in the brief says the judge, Stephen Everett, a tremendous judge, would not let Donna show emotion. Donna and her lawyers claimed that the trial court deprived her of due process and a fair trial by repeatedly admonishing her to not display emotion in front of the jury. I mean, she's been sobbing here for the better part of 2 minutes. Any case to be made regarding that, Tim?
Not really. The judge has full control of his courtroom. It's clearly abuse of discretion. If the judge felt that her behavior was taking away or disturbing the court procedure and witnesses, that's within his parlor. And the court's not going to do that. They take a break or tell her, watch her emotions. That's done every day in court. You can't have people screaming and stuff in court, being emotional when they're trying to get testimony. And it's very disruptive. That's going to be clearly the judge's discretion. And the appellate court is not going to touch that at all.
Tim, do you think Judge Sullivan ever said that to Lindsay Clancy?
No, I did not see that at all.
Yeah, I didn't either. And I actually thought that was wrong. There should have been at least some effort.
Right.
Yeah.
He likes sidebars. He likes sidebars more than any other judge I've seen. Yeah. I've never seen so many sidebars. He started the trial with the sidebar. He's always at sidebar.
Yeah. He's not nearly as strong as Stephen Everett inside that courtroom. But okay, as much as I don't want to play this, the COE cut this sound, so we will play it. Otherwise, I'll get yelled at. Here we go.
The idea that other people plan to cut Danny's life short. And the people who did this are exactly where they deserve to be. But I had no knowledge that this horrible, evil act was going to take place. If I had become aware of this plan before Danny was murdered, I would have stopped it. With not one iota of actual evidence, the state convinced a Tallahassee jury that I solicited and conspired with other people to have Danny killed. Where is the evidence prior to the murder? The evidence beyond a reasonable doubt that the state needed to prove their case. Where is the evidence before July 18th, 2014 at 10:50 in the morning?
Before you continue, Mrs. Adelson, as it relates to this statement, is the defense trying to re-argue the trial?
No, Judge, just giving Mrs. Adelson an opportunity to be heard.
Mrs. Adelson, you certainly can continue. However, the court can take into consideration the utter lack of remorse that you are displaying. Please proceed if you desire to do so.
He's right. He can.
Mm-hmm. I love it.
Where is the evidence before July 18th, 2014 at 10:50 a.m. that revealed that I had any involvement in this vile and horrific act? Where is the solicitation and conspiracy evidence? The state needed to show that there was evidence before the murder to convict me. The state couldn't show that because there wasn't any evidence. They were trying an innocent person. It makes you wonder if the jurors were sleeping.
Oh, Jesus. Okay, so Joe Petuta, that's nice, insult all the jurors who sat on this case. Now, the brief says, and this is a direct quote, the court admonished the appellant on numerous occasions that she was not permitted to show any emotion in the presence of the jury. And the lawyers argue this potentially affected how jurors perceived Donna as they listened to testimony about the murder of her former son-in-law and the allegations against her family. The appellate argument effectively asked, did forcing Donna to remain emotionally neutral create an artificial courtroom demeanor that the jury could interpret as coldness or lack of humanity? I mean, first of all, this is at the sentencing, I believe, right, where she's giving her statement. But I mean, Joe, I think he gave her enough leeway. We're going to get up to the fact about her testifying or not in a minute, which is a whole other issue. But seems like he certainly gave her a pretty long leash there before he jumped in to say, you better be careful, because if you don't show remorse, I can factor that into my sentence.
Well, but by the words of the brief, he gave her a long leash because he said he repeatedly told her she shouldn't show emotion. Well, you can't repeatedly tell somebody not to do something unless repeatedly they're doing it. That's so right. He gave, you know, that by that alone, I think goes, and Tim is right. I mean, it's in the discretion of the judge to decide how to run the courtroom and what should or shouldn't be something that the jury is using. The jury is told to stick to the facts, not be swayed by emotion. And to that extent, what she's doing is beyond the sticking to the facts admonition and the duty of the jury to begin with. As to the remorse, she's claiming she didn't do it. So, you know, she doesn't have to get up there and say, I did it and I'm sorry for it. But she can say, you know, I'm really sorry that this happened. And she didn't do it very good. She tried there. You know, if I had known, I would have gone and stopped it. I'm an innocent person. But it was all a me, me, me. It didn't ring like any kind of a feeling that I'm sorry he's dead. And, of course, all the evidence of the trial went the other way. I will tell you, I can't resist in the statement of facts, they have the nerve, when they're talking about what a good relationship she had with him, nerve to say that. And it was only this period when they were fighting as to where the boys were going to be that she got overwrought. And look, she baked him banana bread. Now, if I thought there was one thing, first of all, I don't understand how they got in the brief, the statement of facts anyway. But if I thought there was one thing one wouldn't put in a brief, it would be something that had been so much subject to derision by everybody who heard it. This banana bed breaking that only comes in, I believe, from Wendy on the stand saying her mother baked banana bread. So, you know, it's not the right way to show remorse. It's not, it's just so off the charts. Excuse me, Tim.
No. I wanted to say, Joe, do you think that knowing, comparing Lindsay Clancy in this case, where Lindsay lost three of her children and has psych and didn't understand and is living obviously distraught, whereas Donna was not distraught. She hated him. She was going to dress the kids up. She was going to give him $1 million, that the judge found her antics were not genuine. And yes, it was just playing to the jury. And that's why he admonished her.
Right.
Whereas Judge Sullivan's thinking, these are her children. She did lose these children. I'm going to give some leeway. And that's enough the judge can cover himself.
I think that's a great point. Now, I will say that with Lindsay Clancy, I thought, and I heard Dr. G, Tim, on your, was it last night or the night before? I do think that she, in that emotional outburst, she kept getting more and more. She didn't wear herself out. And he said he thought it might have been performative at the end. And I guess I did, too, with regard to that. But you're exactly right that the differences in the situations, it's an example of how even the same judge would exercise discretion differently because the circumstances are so different.
But also Judge Everett controls his courtroom much tighter than Judge Sullivan.
Yes.
I don't think Everett would let what the prosecutors have been doing. He would have objected. He would have admonished. He would have taken to the side more and say, "What was the? Why the Catholic? Why did you do that? Why did you bring that in? How is that going to get a relevant answer for this jury to decide?" The Sullivan didn't do it.
Yeah, he's kind of soft. There's no doubt about it. Figgy Fargo here says, Donna's attorney should be controlling their client, which leads me back to Tim. I mean, Tim, when you have a volatile defendant, do you have to coach them and warn them and say, hey, this is going to be rough today. You're going to be on a cross-examination and they're going to ask you really difficult questions and it's going to get emotional, but you got to control your emotions. Do you have that conversation with your clients, Tim?
You have that all the time. And you tell them, listen, the jurors are going to watch everything you do, everything you say, every smirk, every smile. They're watching you. They don't know you, but they're going to read the charges. And then when the witness testimony, some bad things that come out, don't make a face. Don't say no. Don't yell, because they're judging you. And if you act that way in a courtroom, then they're going to say, well, if he's acting that way in a courtroom, then God knows what he would be doing outside. He probably did do what they said he did. So you do have coach their behavior. You're not coaching words to say, but yeah, you're being judged.
A little off point here, but since we're on the topic, never give up to Joe. Do you think that the outbursts in the Lindsay Clancy trial could come back potentially to haunt her in an appeal if the Commonwealth loses? Could they come back and say, this judge, by the way, he just had a case overturned, but not enough there, Joe?
No, it's that if the Commonwealth loses, that's the end of it. We have the double jeopardy. You can't do anything after that. Yeah. So there's nothing.
Well, good point there. This is why I didn't go to law school.
It's why you should have gone to law school.
I still really want to go, but only if Tim does my homework. All right. On to the next point here. There's like 8 major points that I counted, but Donna says she was not given a meaningful chance to decide whether to testify. And when I read that, Joe Pituto, I was like, what are you talking about? Because I remember the day she was set to testify. Everyone had been told she's going to testify. They basically said that she was going to testify. And then, like, I don't know, it was 5 different times. Judge Everett is like, have you made a decision? You know, and she's hemming and hawing. Have you made a decision? Hemming and hawing. Okay, you have 5 minutes. So he gave her a specific amount of time. Is this an asinine point on the appeal?
You know, it arguably might have been if he didn't come in the next morning, call them to sidebar, and he probably looked at a couple of cases and said, if you want to testify, even though the defense rested, you can do it. Do you want to take some time? Do you want to talk to counsel about it? And she said no. And he asked her other questions there. So to the extent there was some arguable claim that there shouldn't have been a time limit, it was at the end of the day, give her overnight, that was wiped out because the next morning he said, take more time if you need it. You know, if you want to testify, you can. In addition, a defendant knows when she's arrested that sooner or later she's going to have to make this decision. I am sure that this is discussed along, you know, as you, Tim, you can do this better than I. As you're preparing to go ahead, this has to be a thought. Will you take the stand? Will you not? Here are the pluses and minuses. It isn't as though at that day, when the defense was thinking about resting, that's the first time she had been posed with this question. And he said to her, Judge Everett was exactly right. Do you think that you're the only defendant that's ever been in this situation? So no, I don't think it has any merit.
Yeah. And I mean, Tim, they go on another direct quote from the filed appeal here. We were allowed 20 minutes during the lunch break to speak with Mrs. Adelson. I mean, you had...
That's plenty of time.
Plus, he had a year and a half or whatever it was that she's sitting in jail. Plus, I mean, all the lead time. And they're saying that, we had 20 minutes. But as much as I don't want to do this, let's go back down memory lane for the sake of my marriage. Here's a little more Donna. Yeah, that's
plenty of time.
All right, here we go. More Donna.
Were asked if they had developed an opinion in my case. Those that answered yes also added, I believe she is guilty. Not one person, not one, said, I think she may be innocent. That should have been a clue to the court to grant our motion for a change of venue, but the court denied the motion. One of my jurors admitted during jury selection that she had background information concerning what one of the state's witnesses would be testifying about. Why was she allowed to be on my jury?
What moment?
Another juror.
Mrs. Fulford.
Oh, I didn't hear you.
Mr. Zellman. Again, this has nothing to do with allocution of any sort. This is a raising of grievances, which are properly given to the appellate court.
Right.
What does any of this have to do with sentencing?
Just one moment, please.
Nothing.
He is pissed. I love this guy. Look at the court officer.
Deputy's like,
court officer's like, damn. Look at him. All right. So,
yeah,
point number seven.
Not buying any of this nonsense. And we know this whole statement was not about remorse. It was about her friends and her telling them, I didn't do this. She's maintaining her friends and her witnesses that came up and her husband because she can't admit what she did. And so she's going to use this time and for the boys, the grandsons, to let them know, I didn't do this. I've been framed. We didn't do this. That's the audience. She knew she'd be getting a life sentence.
Yeah, look at this. I needed this gangsta granny reprieve from the Lindsey Clancy trial. I think we all did. I forgot how much I despise old Donna and adore Judge Everett. I kind of wish someone could make me like, I don't know if you call it a jiffy, a meme, whatever the hell you call it, with a jail door rolling back and forth over Charlie's toe. If anyone can do that, send it to me, survivingthesurvivor@gmail.com. It's the little things in life that bring me joy. But Joe Petuto, point number seven here out of, I think, the eight that I have. Donna shockingly says there was no way I could get a fair trial, jury trial in Tallahassee. Same argument that Charlie tried to make. It didn't work. Is it going to work in Donna's case? You heard her. She didn't break it down, but there were, I think, approximately 150 prospective jurors who were individually questioned over 3 days. A number of them indicated that they already believed she was guilty. I think they were all dismissed.
Struck.
I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were all struck is the word, and I think that is the case. But, you know, they hate Tallahassee. They think it's a bunch of hicks. I love Tallahassee. I want to move to Tallahassee. That's a whole other story. But I mean, any grounds here at all for Donna, or is this just going to be going into the empty void?
I think it's going to go into the empty void. First place, Charlie made essentially this argument, different facts, because she claims it's cumulative. There was another trial, so there was more publicity. And his went down in flames at the appellate level. And there doesn't seem to me to be anything more that she's doing. The jurors that she the prospective jurors that she points to didn't serve on the jury. She asked, why did this juror serve? Well, why didn't your lawyer strike? He had peremptory challenges. Or she had peremptory challenges that she could have used. So I think it's going nowhere.
Yeah, David Gaugamel, I love this guy. Look at this, Joe. He's wearing a New Jersey sweatshirt, NJ there, repping the Garden State. Does Donna have air conditioning in prison? I'll find out, because I've actually been trying to get...
Normally the prison system doesn't have...
Oh, my. I'll tell you right now, the COE and I have air conditioning and a fan 1 inch from our bed in our bedroom, and we're both dying at night because the heat is so...
Too much information. Too much information.
Sorry about that, but there's so much heat. There's so much oppressive heat.
Too much information.
You get the point. You're now in a prison. I just can't imagine no AC. I would not survive for a second. But
so, Joe, when you get down to issues 7, 8, and 9, those are usually your weakest issues.
Well, you know, Tim, you're absolutely right. Except this appellate brief doesn't follow any of the rules that one would use in writing an appellate brief. So. You know, you're right. They didn't do it that way, but I wouldn't have surprised if they took their strongest issue and stuck it at the end.
Right.
Maybe that's knowing the only thing they did right.
Yeah, knowing them. But I mean, Tim, the question here is, I guess it would have to be that jury selection was so different from Charlie's and Donna's trial that maybe they would have a shot at it. But it seems like they went through the same or very similar, you know, voir dire process, however you want to say it. The only thing that's different is that they hired Josh Dubin in Charlie's trial and didn't do it for Donna. I mean, but the it's not like the process was different for Donna than Charlie, right?
Right. And the question is, we saw what happened to Charlie's. Did they properly preserve this issue? Did they say, when they said, is this your jury? And they didn't say, I object. We still object. Did you, is this the jury? Are you satisfied with this jury? No, Judge, we want to change the venue. They didn't do that. And did they file it in writing? Did they file their change of motion or venue in writing? I doubt it. I don't recall that.
Great point here, too, from Winnie. So, I mean, there's so many things over so much time. It's hard to remember, but this did happen. What's the purpose of Charlie texting this article about the hitmen and the drug dealers? Even going so far as to say that Dan was buying drugs from an alleged cocaine dealer, why would she care if she wasn't involved? I mean, that's a very salient point because this was before the fact, right?
Remember the birthday? She called Charlie and he said he didn't get the present yet. And it was after those knuckleheads came up there and they couldn't kill him. And she goes, okay, maybe we'll have... That was before the shooting and the murder. And the mother was talking about it. The birthday present.
Yeah, I mean, Joe, my question to regarding all of this is, how do these appellate attorneys know all the nuances of these cases? Like, how do they know, like, some of the things? Like, you wouldn't – I don't even remember this stuff, and I cover it constantly. But how do the – don't the appellate attorneys have to know this case sort of inside and out to make a decision? And how do they get to that point? Because there's so many cases that they're looking at.
Yeah, no, they should know the case very well. They've got the transcript, and they can talk to the trial lawyer. And the transcript, I mean, you're sitting – it's actually in some ways an advantage because they can sit down with the cold record, with the exhibits, read the transcript. It's not the, you know, the pace at which a trial lawyer has to be on his feet and he's doing things, you know, quick. So they have time to look. A really good appellate lawyer already knows the law, you know, the basic, the issues that might come up and the general law. And then you look at more law to decide, is there an issue here worth dealing with? But you've also got to decide, did the trial lawyer properly preserve it? I heard Hufferman say that when he's doing, you know, the first thing that he does is he sits down with a transcript and he finds an issue and says, ah, this one might be a good one. And then he notes that it wasn't properly preserved. And then it's not going to work on appeal unless you claim that the trial lawyer was so bad that he violated the Sixth Amendment, you know, effective assistance of counsel. But Joe, you have the time to look, and you have the time to look at it carefully. A good appellate lawyer. Now, a lot of law school grads do not know how to look at a statement of fact or a transcript, or even more so when a client comes into your office, and think about the facts you need to find. And that's a problem, because there might be an issue sitting there, but if you can't see it as an appellate lawyer, it's as though it didn't exist. That's why you want somebody who's really experienced at it, who's done it a number of times, and not someone who was, as Tim said this, involved in the trial, because you're too close to it and you may not be able to step back and be able to really to look objectively.
Going full circle, I think before you got here, Joe, Tim and I were trying to figure out if sharks are mammals or reptiles, to which we found out they're neither. And then here's this, Tim, from Charlie Blue. Sharks are fish, big ones. Okay. So I've seen some video of some giant sharks off at Cape Cod this summer, by the way,
yeah,
Tim.
A lot of shark bitings and sightings up here.
You couldn't pay me to go in that water, man. What's the water temperature out there right now?
I think it depends where you are. In the Atlantic Ocean, it's probably maybe 70, the hot area.
That's chilly. I'm not going in there. I go up to my ankles. My kids want to go in. They're doing it at their own risk. Don't buy it yet, Sandy Baker. Rise really does work. It's coffee, a mushroom coffee that I drink. I'm going to get you guys a code in the next couple of days to use it. And I'll tell you all about it when we get there. But so this isn't really another claim, Joe Picciuto, but more as sort of an overarching theme here. What they're trying to do also, they're trying to really create distance and space between Charlie and Donna. They're saying you are essentially clumping the Adelsons together. Charlie's case is different than our client Donna's case, and you need to look at her as a separate entity unto her own. She is Donna Sue Adelson. Is that going to work? Are they going to then say, okay, you're right?
That's a true statement.
Yeah.
But where do you go from there? I mean, some of the evidence that was introduced against Charlie is equally relevant to Donna's case. And when you have a conspiracy and you're building, you know, you're looking at what every participant in the conspiracy did, and I'm responsible for it too. So it's a true statement, but it's a so what true statement.
Yeah. And I mean, Joe, as a final question here, because I'm running out of steam doing the trial all day in this, but I mean, is Charlie's rejected appeal, is it basically a foreshadowing of what's to come for Donna? I mean, if anything works in this, what would it be, and will it work? And your final thoughts, Joe?
Yeah, I don't know. If foreshadowing means the appellate court is going to say, we looked at this in this case, so we're not going to look closely here, then no. But to the extent Charlie's case, Donna's case mirrors some of the arguments or close to some of the arguments Charlie made, and they've been rejected once, yes, it is a foreshadowing. As to the point that has the most weight, I think it's the point that there's not enough for murder one. And Tim knows the case that was cited here. He got his defendant a great deal, and Denise Williams is sitting in jail on the conspiracy. So that's the strongest. I think the cases are sufficiently different that they won't win on it, but that's the strongest case. Final thoughts? I continue to be astonished that a woman who had a college education, I believe, who had some level of wealth, who was able to manage and manipulate people as well as over the years she was able to manage and manipulate people, has been able to sit back and be a client in her own case with the consequences to her and do such a really terrible job, from how she tried to handle it to who she hired to represent her, to what she said at sentencing. I mean, wherever you put a pin in this, I say to myself, why would anybody do what she's doing if they wanted to at least have a chance of prevailing? So that's my final thought.
Well, this just goes on and on. Joe, I'm not going to ask Tim this because he's underscored it a million times, but where are you standing on the Wendy indictment as of August 18th at 6:13 p.m. Eastern Standard Time?
I still say what I've said. I think there is enough evidence. I listened to Georgia, you know, at the Tallahassee Bar Association, where she said with regard to Donna's case, they were afraid they didn't have enough to get back past a judgment of acquittal at the end of the state's case. And I do not understand what she's talking about. I think she was only talking about murder one. I don't see how that would apply to a conspiracy. I think the more time that goes, you know, and in some ways, the less likely it is because, you know, people move on to other jobs, people die, people relocate, memories are not as good. But I still think there is enough. And were I Georgia, I would go forward with it because I believe that if they sincerely believe that Wendy has culpability, and I think they do, and if on the facts and the law, they think there is a reasonable chance of getting a conviction, and at least I think there is, then I think a prosecutor, particularly in a case that is so significant, has the responsibility to go forward. Mm. So I'm going to keep my hope here.
Joe is like the snorkel. She is giving us life and breath and hope that it still happens. Tim Jansen, meanwhile, has drowned us all in that chilly Atlantic Ocean with all those sharks that are big fish. Tim, you're a former federal prosecutor. I mean, is there anything that you've heard in this appeal that gives you pause, that gives you concern for the government here? Obviously, a state case, not a federal case, but anything that you've heard that concerns you and your final thoughts here? It could be about shark. Someone said that they want to see more lobster video. Tim, your thoughts on my question and final thoughts.
Yeah, I'll do a video. I did. I cooked some live lobsters last night. Our next door neighbor got out of the canal, took them right from there and cooked them, steamed them. And they were wonderful. The other thing, remember, nothing's really going to happen until Donna's appeal is over, right? Kathy Magbana, well, whether she gets a sentence reduction, not going to happen until Donna's appeal is final. Same with Wendy. Why would you charge Wendy? You may need Wendy again if Donna gets a new trial. So let's see what happens after that appeal is done. Then we'll see what happens, what's going forward. New England's beautiful in July and August. And it's great to see that the Markell case is almost over, at least for Donna and Charlie. And it's really sad to watch the Lindsey Clancy case and the way the prosecution is handling it. I think Kevin is doing a remarkable job for a man of his age to be doing it by himself. And I think he's a brilliant lawyer.
Yeah, and a black belt in karate.
Is he? Is that right?
Yeah, he's black belt in karate. And Tim, he's like you. He's got NG on his license plate for not guilty. Is that what you have? You have something similar.
I do, not guilty.
Yeah, so he has the same thing.
And Tim, if I could just interject, if you want to see what I, in my opinion, at least, is some really good lawyering, very good lawyering by the prosecution and very good lawyering by the defense, it's this Mario Fernandez Saldana case. And the judge is doing a pretty good job, too. It's
Which case is that?
That's Shanna Gardner.
It's Jared Bridengun, the Shanna Gardner, you know, the murder of the...
Tim, I'm going to Jacksonville. I'm going to make you meet me out there.
Threw the tire in the road.
Yeah.
Yes.
He got shot and killed.
And I think the prosecutor, by contrast to the one here, is really doing a first-rate job. They've got two prosecutors, and boy, I think they're doing a great job.
Yeah, there was all kinds of drama with these prosecutors that they were, like, suppressing evidence. Something was going on before. but I'm going to head up for Shanna Gardner, and we'll get Joe and Tim on for that.
When is that?
Shanna Gardner is supposed to start after Fernandez.
Right after this. Jury selection.
They're estimating 2 weeks for this trial. Jury selection.
Saldana was the boyfriend, right? That hired the guy to
put. He's the husband, and he's still the husband. I found out. They're still married.
Right. Yeah, I'll be back. I'll be able to go there, Jack, over there.
All right, sweet. Joe, one last question because this is pertinent to what we're talking about now. Tassie 85, cute cat. Would the state have better luck? Back to the Wendy issue, charging her. Like Donna's crying here as an accessory after the fact. The bigger question is, could they come back and charge her with something that we are not necessarily suspecting, not first degree murder?
They certainly can come back and charge her with something. I don't know.
Perjury.
Yeah, perjury maybe. They could, they could do that. What was the question, though? Are they better off?
I don't know.
Tim is right. They're going to wait on her to see where Charlie and Donna's cases end up after the appeals. And Charlie's going into post-conviction. He's going to just file an attack now and say that Daniel Rochban didn't give him, was ineffective assistance of counsel. So that's going to take a while.
I talked to Ufferman about that, and I think he told me probably filed October.
Oh.
So. Mm.
Breaking news here, Tim. Congratulations.
Yeah, there you go. Everyone, I think in light of the unbelievable heaviness of the Lindsey Clancy show, not to minimize this in any way, but I think we're all on a united front with Donna feeling the same way about her, whereas with Lindsey Clancy, it is completely split in half. Half the people think she needs to go to prison, and the other half believe that she needs to go to a psychiatric hospital. So we will see. Carm has an interesting take on this. I will not reveal what she said to me today, but she said she will come on and tell us. It was kind of interesting to hear her say that, what she said. So, and I don't want to speak for her, and that is a really bad tease, but we will get Carm on to discuss it. In the meanwhile, we will be back tomorrow at 8:50 a.m. for trial coverage. And be here, and we will bring you Lindsey Clancy, day 16 of testimony. Huge thank you to Professor Joe Petuto. Go like and subscribe to Prof. Joe Explains. Like and subscribe to Surviving the Survivor. I didn't say it, so please, it just takes a quick second. And huge thanks to Tan Tim Jansen. Tan Tim Jansen. Say it 10 times. Tan Tim Jansen. Say hello to your better half. Tim, and we will see you guys tomorrow morning. Love you, America. Justice for Dan Markell. We will see you tomorrow.